Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Frank Lloyd Wright was an American giant in the world of architecture. If you didn't know it, you could just ask him. Along with his genius came a supersized ego and appetites and notoriety. Scandal, affairs, divorce, mile-high debts, murder, and fire. Now novelist T.C. Boyle looks at Wright through his passions and his women. This hour, On Point, T.C. Boyle on Frank Lloyd Wright and his new novel, The Women. You can join the conversation. Are you a Wright fan, a Boyle fan? What do you expect when these two showmen get together? Falling Water, Taliesin, The Guggenheim, The Fires Behind Them. With me in the studio is T.C. Boyle, best-selling author of 20 books of fiction, novels, and short stories. His historical fiction has looked at John Harvey Kellogg in The Road to Wellville and sex researcher Alfred Kinsey in The Inner Circle. His new novel is The Women. T.C. Boyle, great to have you back.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
What a perfect subject for you. Frank Lloyd Wright, sort of larger than life, and he knew it, and he played it. Not entirely unlike yourself, good sir.
Well, I like to think of myself, though, as a saint, as opposed to an evil guru. He fits exactly in this little triumvirate of guys that I've talked about. You mentioned John Harvey Kellogg, Alfred C. Kinsey, and now Wright. They were all the great egomaniacs of the 20th century. In fact, my editor said, we'll do a box set, the egomaniacs of the 20th century.
What draws you to egomaniacs?
Well, I think that should be obvious. Some writers, some novelists have unrealistic expectations and seem to be cut from that mold. But, of course, not me.
Not you, of course, and yet, I mean, I guess the answer is obvious. They have grand passions, they have grand dreams, they have a grand sense of themselves. Here, do you see yourself, I mean, you call it The Women, but did you set out to make it a portrait of the women or as much a portrait of Frank Lloyd Wright himself?
Well, first of all, Tom, I have to say that I don't really set out to do anything. I just, I'm an artist. I just am creating something. You know, I've been living in his first California house for 16 years and restoring it, and so I felt...
You actually live in a Frank Lloyd Wright house, the first one that he designed for California. You're north of Los Angeles there.
In Santa Barbara.
And so is it falling apart around you like all
of... It was in fairly good shape, but, you know, my wife and I had to do quite a bit of work. It was listing to the east. It had to be jacked up and so on and so on. So all these years I've been living in the house and brooding about it, and I wanted to be informed by who this guy is. Now... Given that, I've just written The Inner Circle a few years ago about Alfred C. Kinsey, the inventor of sex, as you may recall.
No doubt, yes.
And it was told in the first person by an acolyte.
Mm-hmm.
And here I could have done the same thing, but I wanted something very different. And so I thought that it would be interesting to tell it from the point of view of his four principal women, his three wives and his mistress, to get a different sort of portrait of the great man.
Not exactly entirely different, though. You've got an acolyte here, a little bit of fiction that you brought into the greater fiction, a Japanese apprentice who's come over to Taliesin, Frank Lloyd Wright's famous house in Wisconsin, where his, first wife had grown up? His mother.
His mother's family was from Spring Green, Wisconsin.
That's
where Frank went as a refuge after he had been... a pariah because of running off to Europe with Mamie Borthwick Cheney. He came back. He couldn't stay in society. So he went back to his ancestral homeland here in Wisconsin and built this this grand and beautiful house, which I'm sure many of the listeners have visited. And if you haven't visited, you might want to. It's quite dramatic and beautiful.
Shining brow, it means in Welsh, something like that?
That is his translation of Taliesin. And again, his idea is that organic architecture blends with the landscape, uses natural materials, and doesn't stand apart from it as, for instance, the Victorian houses that were current during his day.
Let's hear a little bit of Frank Lloyd Wright's voice itself. He lived a very long life here. Frank Lloyd Wright, born...
He was just short of 92.
That's right. Born in Richland Center, Wisconsin in 1867, just a couple of years after the Civil War. Didn't die until April of 1959. And here he is in 1957,
talking about Frank Lloyd Wright's life was always in the headlines, from the famous murders at Taliesin and fire that we'll talk about there, his debt, his affairs. Here he is in 1957, the man himself, Frank Lloyd Wright, talking with no less Mike Wallace, who sort of put the scandal charges straight to Wright.
Philadelphia Inquirer magazine section, October 18th, 1953. Said as follows. Some quarters have denounced Wright as an impractical visionary and a pompous windbag.
Yeah?
How do you feel about such criticism, Mr. Wright?
Doesn't affect me particularly.
Doesn't bother you?
Not a bit. You always have to consider the source from which these things come. Now, if somebody I deeply respected had said such a thing, I would be worried. I would feel hurt. But as a piece in a newspaper, going into the gutters of the streets the next day, I don't think it counts much.
I love that tape. Mike Wallace putting it to him that he's been denounced as an impractical visionary and a pompous windbag. And he says, consider the source. That's a piece in the newspaper, blowing into the gutters in the street the next day. You live in one of his houses.
Yes, but Tom, wait, I have to respond to this.
Yes.
I've never heard his voice before.
Yo.
And he has a good point.
Well, sure, fine.
Yeah.
But what do you make of it as someone who lives in one of his houses, who's kind of lived inside his life in preparing and writing The Women, impractical, visionary, and pompous windbag? What say you, T.C. Boyle?
Well, you know, I am primarily a satirist. I mean, I can't look at an icon without, you know, poking a pin in the balloon. But on the other hand, I tremendously admire him as an artist. And, you know, one of the questions that I'm asking in a book like this is, does the art stand apart from any kind of ethical considerations? Do you separate the artist from the art itself?
In his case, fantastic architect. Does that then mean he should not be judged by everyday standards?
If baby rapers make great art, it doesn't really matter. It is great art.
To whom? Not the police.
Or the babies. But I mean, but I'm saying.
Or the neighborhood.
Right. Theoretically, though, the art stands apart from all this. The house exists. He's dead. On the other hand, as a novelist, mm-hmm. I'm very interested in ethical questions. Mm-hmm. And so here is a great guru and, yes, a pompous windbag. Mm-hmm. I think this is a true description, who was very self-satisfied, very egomaniacal, very despotic. What is the effect that he has on the acolyte? When someone gives themselves over to his regime, as you mentioned, the first person narrator, who is an invented character, Tadashi Sato, goes to become an apprentice and live under his master. Well, what does that mean for Tadashi, for the apprentice, for the acolyte? What do you get back from such a relationship?
What about the women?
And the women in his life, what are they getting? Of course, many people will know his biography, since there are something like 1,000 books have been written about Frank Lloyd Wright and his life and work. Briefly, he married a sweetheart when he was very young, Kitty. He was just short of 22. She was just short of 18. He'd met her when she was 16, and they had to wait until she graduated high school before they could be married. He had 6 children. He developed his prairie style. 20 years went by. And he began to get a little restless.
So, worked for Louis Sullivan in Chicago, built a lot of homes in Oak Park, where he lived, was doing some on the side. And Louis Sullivan, who I think designed the first skyscraper, kicked him out of his firm there. But it was a lot of years before the story really cranks up and gets going. He's got 6 kids and a marriage. And then?
And then, of course, he had a sort of midlife crisis and fell in love with the wife of one of his clients, Mama Borthwick Cheney, whose house is right there in Oak Park, and you can see it. I don't know if you can't tour it, but you can see it. It's still there. Ran off to Europe with her and left his wife and 6 children behind with tremendous debts, and she left her 2 children and husband behind as well. Subsequently, there was the tragedy that I think everyone knows about.
Describe that, though, because it's key in the book.
Okay, well, Frank Lloyd Wright was then building the Midway Gardens, a grand beer garden pleasure palace in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So he was commuting back and forth between Spring Green and Chicago.
Wisconsin, Chicago. Mm-hmm.
They had hired 2 servants from Barbados, and there was a falling out, which I'd, you know, dramatize. Mm-hmm. And the male servant, Julian Carlton, murdered Mama and her 2 children quite brutally with a shingling hatchet. and four others, four workmen as well, and burned Taliesin to the ground. Then, what most interests me is that within 6 months of this, receiving all of these sympathy letters, he received one from Miriam Maud Noel, a very elegant woman who'd spent 10 years in Paris, was now back in Chicago, and read about this in the paper and wrote to him. Within 6 months, they were lovers. And he went through the entire thing again and established Miriam as the doyenne of Taliesin.
Another very flamboyant, very colorful doyenne.
Exactly.
And he still wasn't finished.
No. And where my book picks up is, I'm telling the story in reverse order. It picks up with his last wife, Olga Ivanovna, with whom he was lived and with and was married for 31 years.
Former ballet dancer?
Yes, indeedy. She was a disciple of Gurdjieff. So she was already molded perfectly for him to be a disciple of somebody else. And he began to have an affair with her while still married to Miriam, who caused some problems.
Shall we say?
To say the least. She took over the book for me, Tom. She was such a fascinating character, storming Taliesin to repossess it, and always in the company of the press.
The most intimate moments of their marital flame-ups.
Exactly. The letters that he'd written were published in the papers. She loved attention as much as he did.
It's amazing you waited this long to write about Frank Lloyd Wright, but we're glad that you have.
It is. I had been thinking since I moved in 16 years ago that this would make a wonderful fiction, but of course I wrote 12 other books in the interval.
Yeah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist T.C. Boyle about the tempestuous, romantic life of American architect and icon Frank Lloyd Wright, and Boyle's new novel, The Women, about Frank Lloyd Wright's women. Are you a T.C. Boyle fan? Are you ready for Boyle on Frank Lloyd Wright? Here's a little more of Frank Lloyd Wright himself describing his buildings by their organic architecture, his designs. He said his designs came directly from nature, from the forests and hills of the Wisconsin countryside, where much of T.C. Boyle's new book plays out. Here's Wright, age 90, talking with Mike Wallace, 1957.
Are you a religious man yourself?
I've always considered myself deeply religious.
Do you go to any specific church?
Yes, I go occasionally to this one and then sometimes to that one. But my church, I put a capital N on nature and go there.
My church is nature, said Frank Lloyd Wright. That was famously the kind of big approach that he brought to architecture. Did you come to see that as genuine, real? Did it play out in the rest of his life? Did it play out in his intimate, romantic life?
I think so. I think it's true. And furthermore, I agree.
That's
my
church
as well, is nature. Mm-hmm. And, of course, his prairie style, of which my house is an example, demonstrates that. You know, here we're coming from a Victorian era where man dominates nature. Mm-hmm. You've got a big rectilinear structure and a grand entrance and a grand staircase and so on. Mm-hmm. His idea in the prairie style was to make houses that are horizontal, have horizontal lines that blend in with nature, that use natural materials from the building site itself, if possible, and certainly from the area, and that instead of having all the rooms enclosed, they should have an open floor plan, and windows should replace paintings so that nature, outdoors, the woods, and so on, is the painting. And it works. In the house that I'm living in, you look out of all the windows of three stories all the way around, and you see nothing but trees and hills and so on. And it is tremendously relaxing and beautiful.
But as I read your novel, The Women, I kept coming back to what seemed like a kind of contradiction where, yes, whether it's falling water with a beautiful waterfall and those serene lines. I haven't seen your home, but I've seen many Frank Lloyd Wright houses, and that serenity is there, the prairie style. Soothing, all the rest. But his romantic life seemed anything but that. It was all passion and fire, and in a weird way seemed almost Victorian in its Baroque quality.
Absolutely. And so, there's a lot of irony here. The prairie style also is built around a central hearth, and it has an open floor plan so that the whole family can see each other. instead of being boxed off in rooms, you can see through three rooms continuously,
right. mm-hmm.
with glass walls and so on, and glass partitions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always built around a central hearth so the family can gather. And, of course, this is pre-TV, pre-video game, and sing and read poetry and so on. The irony is that the year in which he built my house, 1909, was the year in which he deserted the family with the grocery bill and ran off with another woman.
You would think that an open plan would not work very well for Frank Lloyd Wright, as you describe him, because he's always kind of lurking around, blowing on the embers of a new relationship. I mean, even as the old one is still there, he's bringing in Olga Ivanovna or whoever the next woman may be.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to quite pin that down, Tom. I don't know if you're aware of it, but I am the only writer in American history only to have one wife.
Well, congratulations, sir.
But, you know, it's nice to imagine the allure that these women had for him. Each one was successively more exotic than the other. So here he had Kitty, his first wife.
Mm-hmm.
She was not college educated.
Mm-hmm.
She was his first love.
Mm-hmm.
He himself, despite what he says, only had two semesters of college. He couldn't obviously work under anyone else's regime.
In Madison, Wisconsin, but not for long.
Not for long. Mm-hmm. And so each of these women, and Mema was college educated and very forward-thinking.
Very bright, very feminist for her time.
A feminist. Miriam was not college educated, but had tremendous sophistication from her 10 years in Paris. And, of course, Olga Ivanovna, his last wife, was a mysterious, highly educated, and lovely woman with a fetching accent from Montenegro.
Mm-hmm.
So he was always looking, I think, for something more. And furthermore, the women were complicit in this. They came to him, and he was, in some senses, a victim of them as they were a victim of him as well. I mean, it takes two to tango, et cetera.
Describe his affectations we'd call them. I mean, his cape, his hat, his jodhpurs. This was a guy who wanted to cut quite a figure in all circumstances.
He loved to walk into the room and dominate it. I was just talking last night about someone who had been an assistant of the actress Anne Bancroft, who was his granddaughter.
Mm.
And have I got her name right?
Baxter.
Baxter. Sorry,
Baxter.
I'm sorry. Baxter. Yeah. Anne Baxter. And I can only imagine him attending a movie premiere with her and the other Hollywood types, knowing full well that he is the cynosure of this event.
The cane, the cape, the great sweep of hair, move over Donald Trump.
But again, you know, more power to him. Some writers, of course, are a little bit flamboyant, too.
Just
why
a little,
not?
Yourself?
If that's
quite a lovely scarlet scarf you've got there.
Knitted by that wife, by the way.
Ooh, the ever-faithful.
No, I love to give a show, and I love to be flamboyant. Why not? If that is what your personality says, sure. He demanded attention, and he had a lot of fun with the press, too. All these outrageous comments, like the quote that opens the book. He made them.
That is, Frank Lloyd Wright says in your front piece, early in life, I had to choose between honest arrogance and hypocritical humility. I chose arrogance.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, my gosh.
A lot of this was playful, though. You know, he wanted attention, whether it was like the bad kid in school who can't get attention for being good, so he acts out. He didn't necessarily want to be arrested on Mann Act charges.
Though he was when which one of his women came after him?
That was when Miriam came after him because he was with Olga Ivanovna.
Crossing state lines with a young woman.
Exactly.
She used the law to come after him.
Exactly. I don't think he wanted that. And yet notoriety, good or bad, was what he sought to feed his own ego. On the other hand, I admire him so much as an artist. He again, of course, the metaphor here is that it's simple. It's very similar to build a house and to build a novel. We both mm-hmm. dream.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he started with a drawing, an artist's rendering of what it would look like before he even drew the plans.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps I work the same sort of way. I see something and I mm-hmm. begin. Maybe I don't have set plans.
Mm-hmm.
It's more improvisatory. But he was famous for being improvisatory on the job site, which is why, of course, everything had these tremendous cost overruns.
Mm-hmm. And he was always scraping for money and stiffing people on his debts. We should read a little bit from his T.C. Boyle from the new novel, The Women. And this is where Miriam, who is quite a character and with her own drug issues and all the rest, shows up at Taliesin. There in Wisconsin, and it's Olga Ivanovna sort of looking down across the way from the house to see the unbelievable spectacle that's unfolding kind of at the front gate of the drive.
Yes, and I'll set it up just a little bit more.
Please.
Miriam was a morphine addict. She was also somewhat mentally imbalanced. and she lived with Frank in opprobrium for 9 years as his mistress. Mm-hmm. Finally, he married her, mm-hmm. and 6 months later, she left him. Now she has discovered that he's established a new and much younger woman at Taliesin who is also pregnant.
Olgivanna.
And so Miriam has come in the company of a group of reporters to go back into her house as the rightful wife. And here she is. And this is observed by Olgivanna, by the way, who is hiding in the house.
And who wouldn't? It's a fierce onslaught.
It was Miriam. It had to be. She was certain of it even as she shifted the binoculars to focus on the woman's face, but then the figure ducked out of view, erased momentarily by the torsos of the converging men, before coming up triumphant to fling something down in the dirt in a dull blur of color. Another shout. The men smirking, easing forward. A photographer there setting up his tripod, the sun exploding against the windows of the cars, and the woman whirling away from them all to stamp furiously at that thing in the dirt as if she were killing it. Only then did she stand still long enough to reveal herself. Olgivanna had seen Miriam in the flesh just once, in the corridor of the hospital. But she must have studied the photographs of her 100 times, fixated on her, fascinated, every line of her rival's face as familiar to her as her own. And now here she was, unmistakable, Miriam in all her belligerent glory come to claim her own. She recognized the pug nose, the set of the jaw, the clamped, insatiable mouth, and the outsized hat slipped down over the eyebrows, and the eyes themselves, so startled and wide it was as if she'd been pricked with a pin every minute of her waking life. It gave Olgivanna a strange thrill to see her this way, reduced at the end of a long optical tunnel, flattened and derealized, but it was short-lived. Any minute now, she was sure of it. Billy Weston would stand back and Miriam would pass through the gates and sally up the drive with her horde of reporters. And what then? Would they have to run out into the fields and hide, crawl under the beds? And where was Frank?
T.C. Boyle, reading from his new novel, The Women, you had to have an iron disposition to be a woman. Frank Lloyd Wright, at least as I read you here. Let's go to our listeners, if we may. Teresa is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Teresa. You're on the air with T.C. Boyle.
Hi. I'm actually calling from Manchester, Mass.
Oh, great. So. Great to have you.
But a couple things. My uncle, who I'm an architect and a woman, and my uncle was an architect, and he actually got an invitation from Frank Ligory in the 40s to come to Taliesin. Mm-hmm. He did not take it up, but I heard a lot about it and found the letter, you know, after he had died. And also, I was an apprentice with Paolo Soleri, who was once an apprentice of Frank Lloyd Wright's, and he went off and started his own atelier in Scottsdale, making these sand bells that people might be familiar with.
Side of Taliesin West out that way.
Well, actually in Scottsdale, and he, outside of Taliesin West. And now he is building a city called, you know, it's Arcosante also in Arizona.
Teresa, may I ask you, as a woman and an architect, when you look back at this outsized figure, this character, this Svengali kind of aspect, self-satisfied, T.C. Boyle calls him egomaniacal, despotic, do you forgive Frank Lloyd Wright all that? As a woman, do you care? As an architect, do you see it as essential?
I've encountered quite a few male architect ego. I worked for a big one in Washington. I won't mention his name. But there's a lot of ego going on in that profession. And I think artists, and even he reminds me a little bit of Albert Einstein, you know, who had his coterie of women.
May I ask you how you feel as an architect? Do you feel that you can't cooperate with people and that you are the gift of God to the world of architecture? Or is it somewhat in between?
Well, I have made a point of, especially after working under someone who was very much that way, mm-hmm. and was a brand, and people came to him for his type of architecture, and he dictated everything down to what gown the owner would wear. And I find myself more attuned with the clients and working with them a little more. I mean, I still want to make a statement, but I really like to work together. And I think I love Frank Lloyd Wright's work. In fact, I'm looking at his early houses now. But it's kind of too bad because the mass is having this image of an architect only being that way. And I think it's important to know that there are those of us out here who do work with people and try to educate people as well.
Well, as you may know, I mean, he was such a control freak that it is true that he not only designed, in some cases, houses, but also the furnishings, the plate, the silverware, and even in some cases, the dresses that the Hausfrau was going to wear. It's almost, when I look at it, it's almost playful. It's as if, it's like having a playhouse when you're a kid and you put characters in it. He was famously prickly about the actual owner occupying the artwork because the owner brings all his various furnishings with him and they're just plain wrong. I can appreciate that. But again, what I do, all I need to do is sit in a room. And in the past, I needed paper. Now I just have a computer.
Right.
But he had to really deal with, as you do, with clients who are paying the bills. Mm-hmm. That must be very difficult.
Mm-hmm. You know, Teresa, thank you so much for your call. T.C., we heard Frank Lloyd Wright talking earlier about how his religion was nature. Now, today, when we think of people who worship nature, it brings to mind, if you live in California, or maybe if you're in Vermont, it brings to mind kind of Birkenstocks and tolerance and laid back. It doesn't exactly bring to mind Poseidon rising from the sea.
I've been working with this for a long while. And again, I had never heard his voice before mm-hmm. or that statement, although, of course, I knew that that mm-hmm. was his God, nature. Mm-hmm. I agree. I had written a book a few years back called Drop City about the hippie movement and a group of people living on a commune and trying to go back and live closer to nature. I mean, this is a very attractive idea from the beginnings of America on, to have mm-hmm. a kind of utopian society. Personally, though, I spend a lot of my time, at least a couple of months a year, in the Sequoia National Forest. I will work in the house during the day, and mm-hmm. then I will just walk into nature by myself mm-hmm. to feel something bigger than me, to get beyond names and words so that I'm not worried about the fact of this is a sugar pine or a Jeffrey pine mm-hmm. or that mm-hmm. the squirrels are going extinct or whatever it is. It's just the kind of wonder that you have when you're a child. Before you really know or care about that, it's just, wow, look at that. What's around the next corner? And I don't know if this is a religious feeling exactly, as the transcendentalists might say, mm-hmm. But it does free your mind. It cleanses your mind and opens the unconscious in a way that I don't find walking around in the city, for instance.
But did Frank Lloyd Wright find that humility in nature, or did he just find kind of the template for the next grand house, grand project, grand imposition of Frank Lloyd Wright upon the world?
I think choice A. Like me, he was a workaholic and only existed for his work. But he also took great pleasure in being a country boy and living on this estate and, you know, going out and scything the grass along with the apprentices and chopping wood and taking care of the animals and doing all of those things mm-hmm. and working with the workmen on the project mm-hmm. also. Mm-hmm. He loved the physical labor and to be outdoors and to ride his horse, to take walks, to go ice skating, to swim. You know,
sounds like the perfect guy. Did he feel guilty when his despotic side came out then later and he exploited those same acolytes that he baled hay with?
In our lives, we meet many great figures. I am a fan of innumerable artists, many, many different kinds. Mm-hmm. But I don't give myself over to them. And again, back to what we said at the outset, mm-hmm. what is it to give yourself over to another artist? And of course, our whole history, not only in art but in politics, is a question of giving yourself over to some leader who is going to define for you his vision of the world and make you all right, redeem you in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not like that, Tom. I just want to entertain you. Read my books. You'll have a happy life.
What are you doing standing up on the table with your arms spread wide? Maybe not.
Well, you know, of course, I'm not trying to impose my will on anybody, whereas Frank Lloyd Wright, Kinsey, and Kellogg were so obsessed with their own vision that, and they, of course, needed acolytes. They needed people to embrace it and to help them to build it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with novelist T.C. Boyle about the tempestuous love life of American architect and icon Frank Lloyd Wright and T.C. Boyle's new novel, The Women. T.C. Boyle is with me in the studio. I've got from the website, T.C., a comment here from Tiffany at onpointradio.org. She says, a different angle on Frank Lloyd Wright. My grandmother, she writes, was a Frank Lloyd Wright fellow from 1944 to 47, kind of like your imagined character Tadashi Sato. My grandmother adored Mr. Wright. She always said that all the books and stories never capture how smart and wickedly funny he was. He made Olga Ivanovna build the Guggenheim, of course, the Guggenheim Museum, model in popsicle sticks. She had to eat hundreds of popsicles. I don't know if that's the apprentice or Olga Ivanovna. I also remember the time I fell down his stone steps. Frank came running down and picked me up and said, "My God, Maggie, don't hurt yourself. There are so few of us." This is a kind of, this is the warm, enveloping, wonderful Frank Lloyd Wright.
Well, I mean, we're all a pile of contradictions.
Yes,
and I think this gives a fairly full portrait, this book. If you don't know anything about him, you'll see his whole life. And you'll get a lot of this kind of information. And, of course, he was incredibly magnetic and dynamic and known for his wit and energy as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I mean, how could he have done this without being that sort of superhuman kind of person who has energy from morning till night?
A kind of open furnace. Let's go to Buffalo, New York, Frank Lloyd Wright territory, and Alice. Hi, Alice. You're on the air.
Hello, Jim.
Hi, hi.
Hello.
We have several Frank Lloyd Wright homes in Buffalo.
Yes.
One of which is now being restored as a museum. And we rather revere him here. Mm-hmm. And I personally have no interest in his personal life. It sounds like gossip.
It is indeed. And in fact, he was he stoked the tabloids of the day because, of course, he was one of the leading figures of the day long before we had movie stars and soap opera stars, etc. I should say to you that I married a Buffalo gal, and her sister lives three blocks from the Darwin Martin House, which is one of his most enduring and great creations. Unfortunately, as you are, I'm sure, are well aware, it has been decimated over the years, but I do understand, and perhaps you could give us some information here, that it is now being reconstructed. Is that correct?
That's true. The grounds and everything. It's a major development and a lot of money being spent.
Very grand. One of his prairie houses with beautiful lines here. I'm looking at a photo right now.
Buffalo's weather doesn't seem conducive to that kind of architecture.
Well, yes.
The snow lying on those great horizontal plains.
I have been to the Darwin Martin House on several occasions, but not for the last maybe 2 or 3 years. The house I'm living in has all of these casement windows, for instance, and could never really exist in a cold climate. There would be no way to heat such a house. Mm-hmm. It'd be impossible.
But Santa Barbara, it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, we might get to, you Boston people will really, really love this. You know, every once in a while when the sun goes down in December, I have to put a shirt on at the beach.
Oh,
you know?
Boy.
No, no. I mean, it gets to be maybe 50 at night, and the house holds
absolutely
the cold.
Terrifying.
But it has a great, great big hearth, which I use. And there is a furnace, but you don't need it much.
Alice doesn't want to know the details, but yet it seems from what I've read here in your book and beyond, almost everyone did, and Frank Lloyd Wright helped the country not only become acquainted with his designs, which he was very proud of, but with his sort of scandalous private life. He was a publicity hound.
Yeah, well, I must explain to her that as a novelist, I'm interested in the what and the why and the how. You know, the biographers have been great and have given us a lot of the material, which I'm drawing from. Mm-hmm. We know the lineaments of his life. I've went to the newspapers and I read the stories about Miriam we just quoted, storming Taliesin.
And,
yeah,
mm-hmm. Storming. Mm-hmm.
But really, my job is to inhabit these characters and find out what makes them tick and how they might have felt about things. That is the fun of it for me. This is why I am only a fiction writer. I mm-hmm. don't write essays or biographies. I don't work in the movies. I have no interest in that. I love to dream what it might have been like, especially in these historical novels of mine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's go to Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. Speaking of great charismatic egoists, whatever, his fourth mistress or wife, Olga Giviana, I believe was a very close follower of Gurdjieff, who is, I have a lot of friends who in the 60s went to an institute in England that followed the teachings of Gurdjieff. So I'm just wondering, and Gurdjieff was born actually a year before Frank Lloyd Wright. It's interesting. I was wondering if Frank Lloyd whether he got involved or just let Olegiviana, whatever, carry on with that, because I think she was a devotee for all her life.
Yes,
and
yes.
What the relation was between the two.
TC, can you introduce us to Gurdjieff?
Yeah, you know, he was, as our caller says, a mystic who and a cult figure who developed a cult around him. And the book does go into this. Olegiviana came to Frank Lloyd Wright from Gurdjieff. She had been one of his dancers.
Mm-hmm.
She had lived with him in Fontainebleau in Paris. And the year before she came to America, he had had an auto accident, a very severe one.
Mm-hmm.
And she nursed him through it, made sure that he had enough wood for the winter, mm-hmm. and then he cast her out because he wanted to reestablish himself without his followers. And then she took up with another cult hero. But to answer your question, Frank Lloyd Wright, of course, could never fall under anyone's regime. He was, in his own mind, supreme and would never, never consider anything like this. However, according to some of the biographers, mm-hmm. Adelwise Huxtable, for instance,
mm-hmm.
It was Olegiviana's training with Gurdjieff that enabled her to run the Taliesin menage.
Because all the apprentices
exactly.
and staff.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
She became sort of mistress of the grounds and palace, even when she was under attack there later by the oncoming Miriam.
But especially after Miriam had died, mm-hmm. and now into the 30s, 40s, and 50s,
mm-hmm.
She became a very strict disciplinarian and in some cases managed the love lives of the young apprentices. And again, according to the biographers, some of the biographers, this might have resulted from her years with Gurdjieff.
You describe the moment in The Women when Frank Lloyd Wright and Olegiviana meet at the ballet in Chicago. And as you describe, there's a kind of instant recognition that these are pieces to fit together. Share that.
Yeah. Miriam had left Frank, and he was at a ballet. And he saw this exotic-looking woman who was dressed differently from the usual American crowd and had her hair swept back and was sort of exotic. There is some suggestion that she knew he would be there,
mm-hmm.
and came in order to meet him. At any rate, he always had his eye out for a woman, especially when he was now alone, and very quickly they developed a relationship almost immediately.
Do you consider Frank Lloyd Wright to have been unusually needy when it came to the company of women, or just an ordinary man in extraordinary circumstances?
Well, he was a mama's boy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another element that is fascinating in his life and the drama of his life. His father left the family when he was 17. His mother cast him out, in fact.
The father out.
Cast mm-hmm. the father out, mm-hmm. and had always lived just for Frank and pampered him and told him he was a genius. And in fact,
bought him a set of blocks when he was very young that he played with that look a lot like prairie-style homes.
Exactly, and also decided that he would be an architect and mm-hmm. cultivated this. And
mm-hmm.
he did have two sisters, but the mother was devoted to him. And so I think, yes, he did need this sort of attention. And by the way, the stories that I tell in the book are all true to what we can glean from
mm-hmm.
the biographies. So
mm-hmm.
that when he was in Japan building the Imperial Hotel, suffering mm-hmm. from dysentery.
Famously now gone, but famously there.
Mm-hmm. His 80-year-old mother took the train all the way across the continental U.S., the 2-week boat trip to Tokyo
Good
in order
Lord.
To nurse her boy, even though his wife Miriam was at his side. So there are complications within complications here, Tom. And for me, it just made for a delightful story in the spinning out of it.
Oh, and no kidding. Let's go to Peter in Providence, Rhode Island. Peter, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
I also am an architect, and also, I like one of your previous callers, I worked for Paolo Soleri for a while.
Hmm.
So in a certain way, I'm a follower in that line of acolytes, but
uh-huh.
I'm not an acolyte.
Okay.
And I wanted to bring up the kind of parallels between Frank Lloyd Wright and Stamford White and how they dealt
yes.
with women. And sort of the image that they all, as you may know, Stamford White had numerous affairs with young women, usually in their teens. And one of them led to him being murdered by Harry Thaw.
In 1906, and then in 1909 was when Frank ran off with Mema. So, yeah, I think that was very much in the mind of the press at the time.
Yeah, Il Doctorow picking that up. As
and right, Il Doctorow had written about it as well,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Right, and I think both of them influenced what has been, I think, a curse on my profession, which is the Fountainhead and Howard Rourke, and this sort of image as an architect, as a god who needs to, you know, impose his will.
Meryl Sechrist, the wonderful biographer of Frank Lloyd Wright, tells that story that Frank found out about the Fountainhead and that Rourke was based somewhat on
Ayn Rand's book,
and he. He asked one of his apprentices to read it and tell him if it was any good. And the apprentice said, no, you don't want to read it. And subsequently, though, Ayn Rand came to Taliesin and spent a few days there. I can only imagine. Again, you had his voice on tape, Tom. What if we had a film of 10 minutes of
together?
Those two talking? It would have been so
great.
Wow,
a mushroom cloud over Spring Green, Wisconsin. Peter, thanks very much for your call. There again, that sort of look at architects as... as you say, the self-image, godlike, and maybe that encouraging a certain relationship between the sexes, or at least.
And by the way, I'm not trying to impose the role of the novelist on the architect. You know, novelists are already writing about poets and painters as a stand-in for themselves. I don't know that many architects. I don't know how flamboyant they can be, but certainly we novelists are guilty of that sort of kind of controlling of the world and wanting to communicate and express ourselves to the world.
You write it just the way you want it. You may even envy Frank Lloyd Wright his cape and cane.
Well, I'm getting there, Tom. Wait till I get a few more years on me.
Jodhpur is up next. Alice in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air with T.C. Boyle.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just wanted to say that as someone who's worked a lot on Frank Lloyd Wright's clients, particularly in his early career.
What do you mean you've worked on them? As a massage therapist or otherwise?
No, I'm an architectural historian.
Oh, very good. Great.
And I've written about Frank Lloyd Wright and his women clients in a book on women clients of modern architecture.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to say that I find it interesting. You know, I know that the reputation of Wright is as quite a ladies' man, and that's absolutely true. But particularly in his early career, he was seen as an extremely sensitive figure to feminist issues and to the concerns of women as wives and mothers and in terms of their making their homes a spiritual and nurturing place.
Yes, that's terrific. Meryl Sechrist, who I was mentioning earlier, talks about his relationship with people like Aileen Barnsdall, for instance. He always sought out very strong women with strong ideas who were in the forefront of what was happening so that these became his clients. I don't think the ordinary people, women or men, would have embraced him at the time.
Certainly, Mamie Bothrick Cheney fell in this camp.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So this is not... Frank Lloyd Wright, the conqueror, or he who demands the acolyte exactly, it's Frank Lloyd Wright looking to strong women, sort of out on the cutting edge.
And even in the house I'm living in, the Stewart House, it's called the George C. Stewart House, but people are beginning to call it the Emily and George C. Stewart House because it was Emily Stewart, the wife, who was the motivating force behind building this house.
Alice, thanks very much for your call. Let's get one from Florida, Fort Myers. And Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, yes.
Hi. What do you know, Tom?
My wife and I lived in southwestern Wisconsin near Taliesin East, and Mr. Wright was in the newspaper all the time, and he was always behind in his power bills. My wife worked for the power company and in the grocery store, but you could tell when he was in town because of the way he dressed. He got a lot of publicity from the Madison paper. The editor, Mr. Evue, was a big fan of his, and I remember when he died and they had this big funeral procession with a wagon and flowers. And
So would you describe him as having been beloved as a local hometown hero or something else, Tom?
Except for those people that he owed money to.
Which was everybody. You know, I love your comment because you're living history here. And I also noticed that you referred to him as Mr. Wright, which is what all the apprentices and all the people extant whom I've spoken to this is how they refer to him. Mr. Wright, always very formal.
Tom, thanks very much for that firsthand. Your wife following Frank Lloyd Wright's, Mr. Wright's power bills down to the power company. Unpaid.
That's great.
Unpaid, we note.
So it continues.
Did he ever change his attitude? He had a long life. Late in his life, did he have regrets about the women?
I don't really know. I'm not an expert on this, and I'm not a psychiatrist either. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. And as far as the power bill and the grocery bill and so on, he considered a bill just a kind of memorial, really. It didn't really affect any kind of exchange of specie, you know?
I'm not sure I quite follow that, but I'd like to learn how to, meaning it was just sort of a, it noted an event or
he
an exchange.
Known, he was known as Slow Pay Frank.
Do you think that the old hatchet murder and fire, was that somehow a reflection of something in Frank Lloyd Wright, or was that just a...
Certainly the papers took it up, and the local preachers who had been condemning him for living in sin. And they call this God's retribution on him as a sinful man.
But then that's the American way when there's a tragedy for God's retribution to be called down or cited.
Exactly. And in his era, which was very much more puritanical than ours, maybe a little bit more, a little bit more. They were just waiting for this. I think people, his enemies certainly, and his critics, well, probably felt that this was justified and deserved on his part.
Did you end up more or less admiring of Frank Lloyd Wright after this long bath in Mr. Wright's world?
More so, simply because I learned so much about the architecture. I had been a babe, and I didn't know what I should have known.
Well, it is truly splendid, and we've got a more intimate view of the man and relationships alongside and woven through and behind that architecture than ever before with this wonderful novel. T.C. Boyle's new book is The Women. It's great to see you. Thanks for coming through town. Thanks for joining us right here in the
studio. My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, you can read an excerpt of T.C. Boyle's new novel, The Women, at our website, onpointradio.org. You can continue the conversation there as well, onpointradio.org. Lots to see. Share your comments with us. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.